and you, stand by with torches. The wilding archers shot as they advanced. They would dash forward, stop, loose, then run another 10 yards. There were so many that the air was constantly full of arrows, all falling woefully short. A waste, John thought. Their want of discipline is showing. The smaller horn and wood bows of the free folk were outranged by the great yew longbows of the Night's Watch, and the wildlings were trying to shoot at men 700 feet above them. "Let them shoot," John said. "Wait! Hold!" Their cloaks were flapping behind them. "The wind is in our faces. It will cost us range. Wait!" Closer, closer. The skins wailed, the drums thundered, the wilding arrows fluttered and fell. "Draw!" John lifted his own bow and pulled the arrow to his ear. Satin did the same. And Gren, Owen the Oaf, Spareboot, Blackjack Bulwer, Aaron, and Emmerich. Zay hoisted her crossbow to her shoulder. John was watching the ram come on and on, the mammoths and giants lumbering forward on either side. They were so small he could have crushed them all in one hand, it seemed. If only my hand was big enough. Through the killing ground they came. 100 crows rose from the carcass of the dead mammoth as the wildlings thundered past to either side of them. Closer and closer, until loose! The black arrows hissed downward like snakes on feathered wings. John did not wait to see where they struck. He reached for a second arrow as soon as the first left his bow. Notch! Draw! Loose! As soon as the arrow flew, he found another. Notch! Draw! Loose! Again and then again. John shouted for the trebuchet and heard the creak and heavy thud as 100 spiked steel caltrops went spinning through the air. "Catapults!" he called. "Scorpions! Bowmen, loose at will!" Wildling arrows were striking the wall now, 100 feet below them. A second giant spun and staggered. Notch, draw, loose. A mammoth veered into another beside it, spilling giants on the ground. Notch, draw, loose. The ram was down and done, he saw. The giants who'd pushed it, dead or dying. "Fire arrows!" he shouted. "I want that ram burning!" The screams of wounded mammoths and the booming cries of giants mingled with the drums and pipes to make an awful music, yet still his archers drew and loosed, as if they'd all gone as deaf as dead Dick Follard. They might be the dregs of the Order, but they were men of the Night's Watch, or near enough as made no matter. That's why they shall not pass. One of the mammoths was running berserk, smashing wildlings with his trunk and crushing archers underfoot. John pulled back his bow once more and launched another arrow at the beast's shaggy back to urge him on. To east and west, the flanks of the wilding host had reached the wall unopposed. Their chariots drew in or turned, while the horsemen milled aimlessly beneath a looming cliff of ice. "At the gate!" a shout came. "Spareboot, maybe. Mammoth, at the gate!" "Fire!" John barked. "Gren! Pip!" Gren thrust his bow aside, wrestled a barrel of oil onto its side, and rolled it to the edge of the wall, where Pip hammered out the plug that sealed it, stuffed in a twist of cloth, set it alight with a torch. They shoved it over together. 100 feet below, it struck the wall and burst, filling the air with shattered staves and burning oil. Gren was rolling a second barrel to the precipice by then, and Keggs had one as well. Pip lit them both. "Got him!" Satin shouted, his head sticking out so far that John was certain he was about to fall. "Got him! Got him! Got him!" He could hear the roar of fire. A flaming giant lurched into view, stumbling and rolling on the ground. Then suddenly the mammoths were fleeing, running from the smoke and flames, and smashing into those behind them in their terror. Those went backward too, the giants and wildlings behind them scrambling to get out of their way. In half a heartbeat, the whole centre was collapsing. The horsemen on the flanks saw themselves being abandoned, and decided to fall back as well, not one so much as blooded. Even the chariots rumbled off, having done nothing but look fearsome and make a lot of noise. When they break hard, Jon Snow thought, as he watched them reel away. The drums had all gone silent. "How'd you like that music, Mance? How'd you like the taste of the Dornishman's wife?" "Do we have anyone hurt?" he asked. "The bloody bugger's got my leg." Spareboot plucked the arrow out and waved it above his head. "The wooden one!" A ragged cheer went up. Zay grabbed Owen by the hands, spun him around in a circle, and gave him a long, wet kiss, right there for all to see. She tried to kiss John, too, but he held her by the shoulder and pushed her gently but firmly away. "No," he said, "I am done with kissing." Suddenly he was too weary to stand, and his leg was agony from knee to groin. He fumbled for his crutch. "Pip, help me to the cage. Gren, you have the wall."
"Me?" said Gren. "Em?" said Pip. It was hard to tell which of them was more horrified. "But,"
Gren stammered,
but what do I do if the wildlings attack again?"
"Stop them," John told him. As they rode down in the cage, Pip took off his helm and wiped his brow.
"Frozen sweat. Is there anything as disgusting as frozen sweat?"
He laughed.
"God, I don't think I've ever been so hungry. I could eat an oryx whole, I swear it. Do you think Hub will cook up Gren for us?"
When he saw John's face, his smile died.
"What's wrong? Is it your leg?"
"My leg," John agreed. Even the words were an effort.
"Not the battle, though. We won the battle."
"Ask me when I've seen the gate," John said grimly. "I want a fire, a hot meal, a warm bed, and something to make my leg stop hurting," he told himself. But first he had to check the tunnel and find what had become of Donal Noy. After the battle with the Thens, it had taken them almost a day to clear the ice and broken beams away from the inner gate. Spotted Pate and Keggs and some of the other builders had argued heatedly that they ought just to leave the debris there, another obstacle for Mance. That would have meant abandoning the defence of the tunnel, though, and Noy was having none of it. With men in the murder holes and archers and spears behind each inner grate, a few determined brothers could hold off 100 times as many wildlings and clog the way with corpses. He did not mean to give Mansraider free passage through the ice. So with pick and spade and ropes, they had moved the broken steps aside and dug back down to the gate. John waited by the cold iron bars, while Pip went to Maester Aemon for the spare key. Surprisingly, the maester himself returned with him, and Clydus with a lantern.
"Come see me when we are done,"
the old man told John, while Pip was fumbling with the chains.
"I need to change your dressing and apply a fresh poultice, and you will want some more dream wine for the pain."
John nodded weakly. The door swung open. Pip led them in, followed by Clydus and the lantern. It was all John could do to keep up with Maester Aemon. The ice pressed close around them, and he could feel the cold seeping into his bones, the weight of the wall above his head. It felt like walking down the gullet of an ice dragon. The tunnel took a twist and then another. Pip unlocked a second iron gate. They walked farther, turned again, and saw a light ahead, faint and pale through the ice. "That's bad," John knew at once. "That's very bad." Then Pip said,
"There's blood on the floor."
The last 20 feet of the tunnel was where they'd fought and died. The outer door of studded oak had been hacked and broken and finally torn off its hinges, and one of the giants had crawled in through the splinters. The lantern bathed the grisly scene in a sullen reddish light. Pip turned aside to Retch, and John found himself envying Maester Aemon his blindness. Noy and his men had been waiting within, behind a gate of heavy iron bars like the two Pip had just unlocked. The two crossbows had gotten off a dozen quarrels as the giant struggled toward them. Then the spearman must have come to the fore, stabbing through the bars. Still, the giant found the strength to reach through, twist the head off Spotted Pate, seize the iron gate, and wrench the bars apart. Links of broken chain lay strewn across the floor. One giant. All this was the work of one giant.
"Are they all dead?"
Maester Aemon asked softly. "Yes." Donal was the last. Noy's sword was sunk deep into the giant's throat, halfway to the hilt. The armourer had always seemed such a big man to John, but locked in the giant's massive arms, he looked almost like a child. The giant crushed his spine. "I don't know who died first." He took the lantern and moved forward for a better look. "Mag. I am the last of the giants." He could feel the sadness there, but he had no time for sadness. It was Mag the Mighty, the king of the giants. He needed sun, then. It was too cold and dark inside the tunnel, and the stench of blood and death was suffocating. John gave the lantern back to Clytus, squeezed around the bodies and through the twisted bars, and walked toward the daylight to see what lay beyond the splintered door. The huge carcass of a dead mammoth partially blocked the way. One of the beast's tusks snagged his cloak and tore it as he edged past. Three more giants lay outside, half buried beneath stone and slush and hardened pitch. He could see where the fire had melted the wall, where great sheets of ice had come sloughing off in the heat to shatter on the blackened ground. He looked up at where they'd come from. "When you stand here, it seems immense, as if it were about to crush you." John went back inside to where the others waited. "We need to repair the outer gate as best we can, and then block up this section of the tunnel. Rubble, chunks of ice, anything. All the way to the second gate, if we can. Sir Winton will need to take command. He's the last knight left. But he needs to move now. The giants will be back before we know it. We have to tell him—"
"Tell him what you will," said Maester Aemon gently. "He will smile, nod, and forget. 30 years ago, Sir Winton Stout came within a dozen votes of being Lord Commander. He would have made a fine one. 10 years ago, he would still have been capable. No longer. You know that as well as Donald did, John."
It was true. "You give the order, then," John told the Maester. "You have been on the wall your whole life. The men will follow you. We have to close the gate."
"I am a maester, chained and sworn. My order serves, John. We give counsel, not commands."
"Someone must."
"You. You must lead."
"No."
"Yes, John. It need not be for long. Only until such time as the garrison returns. Donald chose you and Corrin Halfhand before him. Lord Commander Mormont made you his steward. You are a son of Winterfell, a nephew of Benjen Stark. It must be you or no one. The wall is yours, Jon Snow."
Arya. She could feel a hole inside her every morning when she woke. It wasn't hunger, though sometimes there was that too. It was a hollow place, an emptiness where her heart had been, where her brothers had lived, and her parents. Her head hurt too, not as bad as it had at first, but still pretty bad. Arya was used to that, though, and at least the lump was going down. but the hole inside her stayed the same.
"The hole will never feel any better," she told herself when she went to sleep.
Some mornings Arya did not want to wake at all. She would huddle between her cloak, with her eyes squeezed shut, and try to will herself back to sleep. If the hound would only have left her alone, she would have slept all day and all night. And dreamed. That was the best part, the dreaming. She dreamed of wolves most every night, a great pack of wolves, with her at the head. She was bigger than any of them, stronger, swifter, faster. She could outrun horses and outfight lions. When she bared her teeth, even men would run from her. Her belly was never empty long, and her fur kept her warm even when the wind was blowing cold. And her brothers and sisters were with her, many and more of them, fierce and terrible, and hers. They would never leave her. But if her nights were full of wolves, her days belonged to the dog. Sandor Clegane made her get up every morning whether she wanted to or not. He would curse at her in that raspy voice, or yank her to her feet and shake her. Once he dumped a helmful of cold water all over her head. She bounced up sputtering and shivering and tried to kick him, but he only laughed. "Dry off and feed the bloody horses," he told her, and she did. They had two now, Stranger and a sorrel porphyry mare. Arya had named Craven, because Sandor said she'd likely run off from the twins the same as them. They'd found her wandering riderless through a field the morning after the slaughter. She was a good enough horse, but Arya could not love a coward. Stranger would have fought. Still, she tended the mare as best she knew. It was better than riding double with a hound. And Craven might have been a coward, but she was young and strong as well. Arya thought she might be able to outrun Stranger, if it came to it. The hound no longer watched her as closely as he had. Sometimes he did not seem to care whether she stayed or went, and he no longer bound her up in a cloak at night. "One night I'll kill him in his sleep," she told herself, but she never did. "One day I'll ride away on Craven, and he won't be able to catch me," she thought, but she never did that either. Where would she go? Winterfell was gone. Her grandfather's brother was at River Run, but he didn't know her, no more than she knew him. Maybe Lady Smallwood would take her in at Acorn Hall, and maybe she wouldn't. Besides, Arya wasn't even sure she could find Acorn Hall again. Sometimes she thought she might go back to Sharna's Inn, if the floods hadn't washed it away. She could stay with Hutpie, or maybe Lord Beric would find her there. Angai would teach her to use a bow, and she could ride with Gendry, and be an outlaw, like Wenda the White Fawn in the songs. But that was just stupid, like something Sansa might dream. Hutpie and Gendry had left her just as soon as they could, and Lord Beric and the outlaws only wanted to ransom her, just like the Hound. None of them wanted her around. "They were never my pack, not even Hutpie and Gendry. I was stupid to think so. Just a stupid little girl, and no wolf at all." So she stayed with the Hound. They rode every day, never sleeping twice in the same place, avoiding towns and villages and castles as best they could. Once she asked Sandor Clegane where they were going. "Away," he said. "That's all you need to know. You're not worth spit to me now, and I don't want to hear your whining. I should have let you run into that bloody castle." "You should have," she agreed, thinking of her mother. "You'd be dead if I had. You ought to thank me. You ought to sing me a pretty little song, the way your sister did."
"Did you hit her with an axe, too?"
"I hit you with a flat of the axe, you stupid little bitch. If I'd hit you with a blade, there'd still be chunks of your head floating down the Green Fork. Now shut your bloody mouth. If I had any sense, I'd give you to the Silent Sisters. They cut the tongues out of girls who talk too much."
That wasn't fair of him to say. Aside from that one time, Arya hardly talked at all. Whole days passed when neither of them said anything. She was too empty to talk, and the Hound was too angry. She could feel the fury in him. She could see it on his face, the way his mouth would tighten and twist, the looks he gave her. Whenever he took his axe to chop some wood for a fire, he would slide into a cold rage, hacking savagely at the tree or the deadfall or the broken limb until they had 20 times as much kindling and firewood as they needed. Sometimes he would be so sore and tired afterward that he would lie down and go right to sleep without even lighting a fire. Arya hated it when that happened, and hated him too. Those were the nights when she stared the longest at the axe.
"It looks awfully heavy, but I bet I could swing it."
She wouldn't hit him with a flat, either. Sometimes, in their wanderings, they glimpsed other people. Farmers in their fields, swineherds with their pigs, a milkmaid leading a cow, a squire carrying a message down a rutted road. She never wanted to speak to them, either. It was as if they lived in some distant land and spoke a queer, alien tongue. They had nothing to do with her, or her with them. Besides, it wasn't safe to be seen. From time to time, columns of horsemen passed down the winding farm roads, the twin towers of Frey flying before them.
"Hunting for stray Northmen," the hound said when they had passed. "Any time you hear hooves, get your head down fast. It's not like to be a friend."
One day, in an earthen hollow made by the roots of a fallen oak, they came face to face with another survivor of the twins. The badge on his breast showed a pink maiden dancing in a swirl of silk, and he told them he was Sir Mark Piper's man, a bowman, though he'd lost his bow. His left shoulder was all twisted and swollen where it met his arm. A blow from a mace, he said. It had broken his shoulder and smashed his chainmail deep into his flesh.
"A Northman it was," he wept. "His badge was a bloody man, and he saw mine and made a jeep. Red man and pink maiden. Maybe they should get together. I drank to his Lord Bolton, he drank to Sir Mark, and we drank together to Lord Edmure and Lady Roslyn and the King in the North. And then he killed me."
His eyes were fever bright when he said that, and Arya could tell that it was true. His shoulder was swollen grotesquely, and pus and blood had stained his whole left side. There was a stink to him, too.
"He smells like a corpse."
The man begged them for a drink of wine.
"If I had any wine, I'd have drunk it myself," the hound told him. "I can give you water and the gift of mercy."
The archer looked at him a long while before he said,
"You're Joffrey's dog."
"My own dog now. Do you want the water?"
"Aye,"
the man swallowed.
"And the mercy, please."
They had passed a small pond a short ways back. Sandor gave Arya his helm and told her to fill it, so she trudged back to the water's edge. Mud squished over the toe of her boots. She used the dog's head as a pail. Water ran through the eye holes, but the bottom of the helm still held a lot. When she came back, the archer turned his face up, and she poured the water into his mouth. He gulped it down as fast as she could pour, and what he couldn't gulp ran down his cheeks into the brown blood that crusted his whiskers until pale pink tears dangled from his beard. When the water was gone, he clutched the helm and licked the steel.
"Good," he said. "I wish it was wine, though. I wanted wine."
"Me too."
The hound eased his dagger into the man's chest, almost tenderly. The weight of his body driving the point through his surcoat ringmail and the quilting beneath. As he slid the blade back out and wiped it on the dead man, he looked at Arya.
"That's where the heart is, girl. That's how you kill a man."
"That's one way. Will we bury him?"
"Why?" Sandor said. "He don't care. And we got no spade. Leave him for the wolves and wild dogs, your brothers and mine."
He gave her a hard look.
"First, we rub him, though."
There were 2 silver stags in the archer's purse, and almost 30 coppers. His dagger had a pretty pink stone in the hilt. The hound hefted the knife in his hand, then flipped it toward Arya. She caught it by the hilt, slid it through her belt, and felt a little better. It wasn't needle, but it was steel. The dead man had a quiver of arrows, too, but arrows weren't much good without a bow. His boots were too big for Arya and too small for the hound, so those they left. She took his kettle helm as well, even though it came down almost past her nose, so she had to tilt it back to see.
"He must have had a horse as well, or he wouldn't have gotten away,"
Clegane said, peering about.
"But it's bloody well gone, I'd say. No telling how long he's been here."
By the time they found themselves in the foothills of the Mountains of the Moon, the rains had mostly stopped. Arya could see the sun and moon and stars, and it seemed to her that they were heading eastward.
"Where are we going?"
she asked him. This time the hound answered her.
"You have an aunt in the area. Might be she'll want to ransom your scrawny ass, though the gods know why. Once we find the high road, we can follow it all the way to the bloody gate."
"Aunt Lysa." The thought left Arya feeling empty. It was her mother she wanted, not her mother's sister. She didn't know her mother's sister any more than she knew her great-uncle, Blackfish. "We should have gone into the castle. They didn't really know that her mother was dead, or Rob either. It wasn't like they'd seen them die or anything. Maybe Lord Frey had just taken them captive. Maybe they were chained up in his dungeon, or maybe the Freys were taking them to King's Landing, so Joffrey could chop their heads off. They didn't know.
"We should go back," she suddenly decided. "We should go back to the twins and get my mother. She can't be dead. We have to help her."
"I thought your sister was the one with a head full of songs," the hound growled. "Frey might have kept your mother alive to ransom, that's true, but there's no way in 7 hells I'm going to pluck her out of his castle all by me bloody self."
"Not by yourself. I'd come too."
He made a sound that was almost a laugh.
"That will scare the piss out of the old man."
"You're just afraid to die," she said scornfully.
Now Clegane did laugh.
"Deaths don't scare me. Only fire. Now be quiet, or I'll cut your tongue out myself and save the Silent Sisters the bother. It's the veil for us."
Arya didn't think he'd really cut her tongue out. He was just saying that the way Pink Eye used to say he'd beat her bloody. All the same, she wasn't going to try him. Sandor Clegane was no Pink Eye. Pink Eye didn't cut people in half or hit them with axes. Not even with a flat of axes. That night she went to sleep thinking of her mother, and wondering if she should kill the hound in his sleep and rescue Lady Catelyn herself. When she closed her eyes, she saw her mother's face against the back of her eyelids.
"She's so close, I could almost smell her."
And then she could smell her. The scent was faint beneath the other smells, beneath musts and mud and water, and the stench of rotting reeds and rotting men. She padded slowly through the soft ground to the river's edge, lapped up a drink, then lifted her head to sniff. The sky was grey and thick with cloud, the river green and full of floating things. Dead men clogged the shallows, some still moving as the water pushed them, others washed up on the banks. Her brothers and sisters swarmed around them, tearing at the rich, ripe flesh. The crows were there, too, screaming at the wolves and filling the air with feathers. Their blood was hotter, and one of her sisters had snapped at one as it took flight and caught it by the wing. It made her want a crow herself. She wanted to taste the blood, to hear the bones crunch between her teeth, to fill her belly with warm flesh instead of cold. She was hungry, and the meat was all around, but she knew she could not eat. The scent was stronger now. She pricked her ears up and listened to the grumbles of her pack, the shriek of angry crows, the whir of wings, and sound of running water. Somewhere far off, she could hear horses and the calls of living men. But they were not what mattered. Only the scent mattered. She sniffed the air again. There it was. And now she saw it, too, something pale and white, drifting down the river, turning where it brushed against the snag. The reeds bowed down before it. She splashed noisily through the shallows and threw herself into the deeper water, her legs churning. The current was strong, but she was stronger. She swam, following her nose. The river smells were rich and wet, but those were not the smells that pulled her. She paddled after the sharp red whisper of cold blood, the sweet, cloying stench of death. She chased them as she had often chased a red deer through the trees, and in the end she ran them down, her jaws closed around a pale, white arm. She shook it to make it move, but there was only death and blood in her mouth. By now she was tiring, and it was all she could do to pull the body back to shore. As she dragged it up the muddy bank, one of her little brothers came prowling, his tongue lolling from his mouth. She had to snarl to drive him off, or else he would have fed. Only then did she stop to shake the water from her fur. The white thing lay face down in the mud, her dead flesh wrinkled and pale, cold blood trickling from her throat. "Rise," she thought. "Rise and eat and run with us." The sound of horses turned her head. Men. They were coming from downwind, so she had not smelled them, but now they were almost here. Men on horses, with flapping black and yellow and pink wings and long shiny claws in hand. Some of her younger brothers bared their teeth to defend the food they'd found, but she snapped at them until they scattered. That was the way of the wild. Deer and hares and crows fled before wolves, and wolves fled from men. She abandoned the cold white prize in the mud where she had dragged it, and ran, and felt no shame. When morning came, the hound did not need to shout at Arya or shake her awake. She had woken before him for a change, and even watered the horses. They broke their fast in silence until Sandor said, "This thing about your mother." "It doesn't matter," Arya said in a dull voice. "I know she's dead. I saw her in a dream." The hound looked at her a long time, then nodded. No more was said of it. They rode on toward the mountains. In the higher hills they came upon a tiny isolated village, surrounded by grey-green sentinels and tall blue soldier pines, and Clegane decided to risk going in. "We need food," he said, "and a roof over our heads. They're not like to know what happened at the Twins, and with any luck, they won't know me." The villagers were building a wooden palisade around their homes, and when they saw the breadth of the hound's shoulders, they offered them food and shelter and even coin for work. "If there's wine as well, I'll do it," he growled at them. In the end, he settled for ale and drank himself to sleep each night. His dream of selling Arya to Lady Arryn died there in the hills, though.
"There's frost above us and snow in the hay passes," the village elder said. "If you don't freeze or starve, the shadow cats will get you, or the keeve bears. There's the clans as well. The burned men are fearless since Timmit 1A came back from the war. And half a year ago, Gunther, son of Gurn, led the stone crows down on a village not 8 miles from here. They took every woman and every scrap of green and killed half the men. They have steel now, good swords and mail hauberks, and they watch the high road, the stone crows, the milk sneaks, the sons of the mist, all of them. Might be You'd take a few with you, but in the end they'd kill you and make off with your daughter.
I am not his daughter.
Arya might have shouted, if she hadn't felt so tired. She was no one's daughter now. She was no one. Not Arya, not Weasel, not Nan, nor Arry, nor Squab, not even Lumpyhead. She was only some girl who ran with a dog by day and dreamed of wolves by night. It was quiet in the village. They had beds stuffed with straw and not too many lice. The food was plain but filling, and the air smelled of pines. All the same, Arya soon decided that she hated it. The villagers were cowards. None of them would even look at the hound's face, at least not for long. Some of the women tried to put her in a dress and make her do needlework, but they weren't Lady Smallwood, and she was having none of it. And there was one girl who took to following her, the village elder's daughter. She was of an age with Arya, but just a child. She cried if she skinned a knee, and carried a stupid cloth doll with her everywhere she went. The doll was made up to look like a man-at-arms, sort of. So the girl called him Sir Soldier, and bragged how he kept her safe. "Go away," Arya told her half 100 times. "Just leave me be." She wouldn't, though. So finally, Arya took the doll away from her, ripped it open, and pulled the rag stuffing out of its belly with a finger. "Now he really looks like a soldier," she said, before she threw the doll in a brook. After that, the girl stopped pestering her, and Arya spent her days grooming Craven and Stranger or walking in the woods. Sometimes she would find a stick and practice her needlework. But then she would remember what had happened at the twins and smash it against a tree until it broke. "Might be we should stay here a while," the hound told her after a fortnight. He was drunk on ale, but more brooding than sleepy. "We'd never reach the area, and afraid we'll still be hunting survivors in the Riverlands. Sounds like they need swords here, with these clansmen raiding. We can rest up, maybe find a way to get a letter to your aunt." Arya's face darkened when she heard that. She didn't want to stay, but there was nowhere to go either. The next morning, when the hound went off to chop down trees and haul logs, she crawled back into bed. But when the work was done, and the tall wooden palisade finished, the village elder made it plain that there was no place for them.
"Come winter, we will be hard-pressed to feed our own," he explained. "And you, a man like you, brings blood with him."
Sandor's mouth tightened. "So, you know who I am?"
"Aye, we don't get travellers here, that's so, but we go to market and to fairs. We know about King Joffrey's dog."
"When these stone crows come calling, you might be glad to have a dog."
"Might be."
The man hesitated, then gathered up his courage.
"But they say you lost your belly for fighting at the Blackwater. They say—"
"I know what they say."
Sandor's voice sounded like two wood saws grinding together.
"Pay me, and we'll be gone."
When they left, the hound had a pouch full of coppers, a skin of sour ale, and a new sword. It was a very old sword, if truth be told, though new to him. He swapped its owner the long axe he'd taken at the twins, the one he'd used to raise the lump on Arya's head. The ale was gone in less than a day, but Clegane sharpened the sword every night, cursing the man he'd swapped with for every nick and spot of rust.
"If he lost his belly for fighting, why does he care if his sword is sharp?"
It was not a question Arya dared ask him, but she thought on it a lot. Was that why he'd run from the twins and carried her off? Back in the Riverlands, they found that the rains had ebbed away and the floodwaters had begun to recede. The hound turned south, back toward the Trident.
"We'll make for River Run,"
he told Arya as they roasted a hare he'd killed.
"Maybe the Blackfish wants to buy himself a she-wolf."
He doesn't know me. He won't even know I'm really me.
Arya was tired of making for River Run. She had been making for River Run for years, it seemed, without ever getting there. Every time she made for River Run, she ended up someplace worse.
He won't give you any ransom. He'll probably just hang you.
He's free to try.
He turned the spit.
He doesn't talk like he's lost his belly for fighting.
I know where we could go, Arya said. She still had one brother left.
Jon will want me, even if no one else does. He'll call me Little Sister and muss my hair.
It was a long way, though, and she didn't think she could get there by herself. She hadn't even been able to reach River Run.
We could go to the wall.
Sandor's laugh was half a growl.
The little wolf bitch wants to join the Night's Watch, does she?
My brother's on the wall, she said stubbornly.
His mouth gave a twitch.
The wall's 1,000 leagues from here. We need to fight through the bloody frays just to reach the Nick. There's lizard lions in those swamps that eat wolves every day for breakfast. And if we did reach the north with our skins intact, there's ironborn in half the castles and thousands of bloody, buggering northmen as well.
Are you scared of them? She asked. Have you lost your belly for fighting?
For a moment she thought he was going to hit her. By then the hair was brown, though, skin crackling and grease popping as it dripped down into the cook fire. Sandor took it off the stick, ripped it apart with his big hands, and tossed half of it into Arya's lap.
There's nothing wrong with my belly,
he said as he pulled off a leg.
But I don't give a rat's arse for you or your brother. I have a brother, too.
Tyrion, Sir Kevin Lannister said wearily, if you are indeed innocent of Joffrey's death, you should have no difficulty proving it at trial. Tyrion turned from the window.
Who is to judge me?
Justice belongs to the throne. The king is dead, but your father remains Hand. Since it is his own son who stands accused, and his grandson, who was the victim, his ass Lord Tyrell, and Prince Oberon to sit in judgment with him. Tyrion was scarcely reassured. Mace Tyrell had been Joffrey's good father, however briefly, and the Red Viper was, well, a snake.
Will I be allowed to demand trial by battle?
I would not advise that.
Why not?
It had saved him in the Vale. Why not here?
Answer me, uncle. Will I be allowed a trial by battle, and a champion to prove my innocence?
Certainly, if that is your wish. However, you had best know that your sister means to name Sir Gregor Clegane as her champion, in the event of such a trial.
The bitch checks my moves before I make them. A pity she didn't choose a kettle black.
Bronn would make short work of any of the three brothers, but the mountain that rides was a kettle of a different colour.
I shall need to sleep on this.
I need to speak with Bronn, and soon. He didn't want to think about what this was like to cost him. Bronn had a lofty notion of what his skin was worth.
Does Cersei have witnesses against me?
More every day.
Then I must have witnesses of my own.
Tell me who you would have, and Sir Adam will send the watch to bring them to trial.
I would sooner find them myself.
You stand accused of regicide and kinslaying. Do you truly imagine that you will be allowed to come and go as you please? Sir Kevin waved at the table. You have quill, ink, and parchment. Write the names of such witnesses as you require, and I shall do all in my power to produce them. You have my word. As a Lannister. But you shall not leave this tower except to go to trial. Tyrion would not demean himself by begging.
Will you permit my squire to come and go, the boy Podrick Payne?
Certainly, if that is your wish. I shall send him to you.
Do so. Sooner would be better than later, and now would be better than sooner. He waddled to the writing table, but when he heard the door open, he turned back and said, "Uncle?" Sir Kevin paused. "Yes?"
"I did not do this."
"I wish I could believe that, Tyrion." When the door closed, Tyrion Lannister pulled himself up into the chair, sharpened a quill, and pulled a blank parchment.
"Who will speak for me?"
He dipped his quill in the inkpot. The sheet was still maiden when Podrick Payne appeared, some time later.
"My lord,"
the boy said. Tyrion put down the quill.
"Find Bronn and bring him at once. Tell him there's gold in it, more gold than he's ever dreamed of. And see that you don't return without him."
"Yes, my lord. I mean, no, I won't return."
He went. He had not returned by sunset, nor by moonrise. Tyrion fell asleep in the window seat to wake stiff and sore at dawn. A serving man brought porridge and apples to break his fast, with a horn of ale. He ate at the table the blank parchment before him. An hour later, the serving man returned for the bowl.
"Have you seen my squire?"
Tyrion asked him. The man shook his head. Sighing, he turned back to the table and dipped his quill again.
"Sansa,"
he wrote upon the parchment. He sat staring at the name, his teeth clenched so hard they hurt. Assuming Joffrey had not simply choked to death on a bit of food, which even Tyrion found hard to swallow, Sansa must have poisoned him. Joff practically put his cup down in her lap, and he'd given her ample reason. Any doubts Tyrion might have had vanished when his wife did.
One flesh, one heart, one soul.
His mouth twisted.
She wasted no time proving how much those vows meant to her, did she? Well, what did you expect, dwarf?
And yet,
where would Sansa have gotten poison? He could not believe the girl had acted alone in this. Do I really want to find her?
Would the judges believe that Tyrion's child bride had poisoned a king without her husband's knowledge?
I wouldn't.
Cersei would insist that they had done the deed together. Even so, he gave the parchment to his uncle the next day. Sir Kevin frowned at it.
Lady Sansa is your only witness?
I will think of others in time.
Best think of them now. The judges mean to begin the trial 3 days hence.
That's too soon. You have me shut up here, under guard. How am I to find witnesses to my innocence?
Your sisters had no difficulty finding witnesses to your guilt. Sir Kevin rolled up the parchment. Sir Adam has men hunting for your wife. Varys has offered 100 stags for word of her whereabouts, and 100 dragons for the girl herself. If the girl can be found, she will be found, and I shall bring her to you. I see no harm in husband and wife sharing the same cell and giving comfort to one another.
You are too kind. Have you seen my squire?
I sent him to you yesterday.
Did he not come?
He came, Tyrion admitted, and then he went.
I shall send him to you again. But it was the next morning before Podrick Payne returned. He stepped inside the room hesitantly, with fear written all over his face. Bronn came in behind him. The sellsword knight wore a jerkin studded with silver and a heavy riding cloak, with a pair of fine-tooled leather gloves thrust through his sword belt. One look at Bronn's face gave Tyrion a queasy feeling in the pit of his stomach.
"It took you long enough."
"The boy begged, or I wouldn't have come at all. I am expected at Castle Stokeworth for supper."
"Stokeworth?"
Tyrion hopped from the bed.
"And pray, what is there for you in Stokeworth?"
"A bride."
Bronn smiled like a wolf contemplating a lost lamb.
"I'm to wed Lollies the day after next."
"Lollies?"
"Perfect, bloody perfect."
Lady Tanda's lackwit daughter
gets a knightly husband and a father of sorts for the bastard in her belly, and Sir Bron of the Blackwater climbs another rung. It had Cersei's stinking fingers all over it.
"My bitch sister has sold you a lame horse. The girl's dim-witted. If I wanted wits, I'd marry you. Lully's is big, with another man's child. And when she pops him out, I'll get her big with mine."
"She's not even heir to Stokeworth," Tyrion pointed out. "She has an elder sister, Felissa, a married sister."
"Married 10 years, and still barren," said Bronn. "Her lord husband shuns her bed. It's said he prefers virgins.
He could prefer goats, and it wouldn't matter. The lands will still pass to his wife when Lady Tanda dies, unless Felissa should die before her mother." Tyrion wondered whether Cersei had any notion of the sort of serpent she'd given Lady Tanda to suckle. And if she does, would she care?
"Why are you here, then?" Bronn shrugged. "You once told me that if anyone ever asked me to sell you out, you'd double the price."
"Yes."
"Is it 2 wives you want, or 2 castles?
"One of each would serve. But if you want me to kill Gregor Clegane for you, it had best be a damn big castle."
The 7 kingdoms were full of high-born maidens, but even the oldest, poorest, and ugliest spinster in the realm would balk at wedding such low-born scum as Bronn.
"Unless she was soft of body and soft of head, with a fatherless child in her belly, from having been raped 50 times.
Lady Tanda had been so desperate to find a husband for Lollies that she had even pursued Tyrion for a time, and that had been before half of King's Landing enjoyed her. No doubt Cersei had sweetened the offer somehow, and Bronn was a knight now, which made him a suitable match for a younger daughter of a minor house.
"I find myself woefully short of both castles and high-born maidens at the moment," Tyrion admitted, "but I can offer you gold and gratitude as before."
"I have gold. What can I buy with gratitude?"
"Oh, you might be surprised. A Lannister pays his debts."
"Your sister's a Lannister, too.
My lady wife is heir to Winterfell. Should I emerge from this with my head still on my shoulders, I may one day rule the North in her name. I could carve you out a big piece of it."
"If and when, and might be," said Bronn. "And it's bloody cold up there. Lollies is soft, warm, and close. I could be poking her 2 nights hence."
"Not a prospect I would relish."
"Is that so?" Bronn grinned. "Admitted imp, given a choice between fucking Lollies and fighting the mountain, you'd have your breeches down and cock up before a man could blink."
"He knows me too bloody well."
Tyrion tried a different tack. "I'd heard that Sir Gregor was wounded on the Red Fork, and again at Duskendale. The wounds are bound to slow him."
Bronn looked annoyed.
"He was never fast. Only freakish big and freakish strong. I'll grant you, he's quicker than you'd expect for a man that size. He has a monstrous long reach, and doesn't seem to feel blows the way a normal man would."
"Does he frighten you so much?"
asked Tyrion, hoping to provoke him. "If he didn't frighten me, I'd be a bloody fool."
Bronn gave a shrug.
"Might be I could take him, dance around him until he was so tired of hacking at me that he couldn't lift his sword. Get him off his feet somehow. When they're flat on their backs, it don't matter how tall they are. Even so, it's chancy. One misstep, and I'm dead. Why should I risk it? I like you well enough, ugly little horsen that you are. But if I fight your battle, I lose either way. Either the mountain spills my guts, or I kill him and lose Stokeworth.
I sell my sword. I don't give it away. I'm not your bloody brother.
No, said Tyrion sadly. You're not. He waved a hand.
Be gone, then. Run to Stokeworth and Lady Lolly's. May you find more joy in your marriage bed than I ever found in mine.
Bronn hesitated at the door.
What will you do, imp?
Kill Gregor myself.
Won't that make for a jolly song?
I hope I hear them sing it.
Bronn grinned one last time and walked out of the door, the castle, and his life.
Pod shuffled his feet. I'm sorry.
Why? Is it your fault that Bronn's an insolent, black-hearted rogue? He's always been an insolent, black-hearted rogue. That's what I liked about him.
Tyrion poured himself a cup of wine and took it to the window seat. Outside, the day was grey and rainy, but the prospect was still more cheerful than his. He could send Podrick Payne questing after Shagger, he supposed, but there were so many hiding places in the deep of the King's Wood that outlaws often evaded capture for decades.
And Pod sometimes has difficulty finding the kitchens when I send him down for cheese.
Timmet, son of Timmet, would likely be back in the Mountains of the Moon by now, and despite what he'd told Bronn, going up against Sir Gregor Clegane in his own person would be a bigger farce than Joffrey's jousting dwarfs. He did not intend to die with gales of laughter ringing in his ears.
So much for trial by combat.
Sir Kevin paid him another call later that day, and again the day after. Sansa had not been found, his uncle informed him politely, nor the fool Sir Dontus, who'd vanished the same night. Did Tyrion have any more witnesses he wished to summon?
He did not. How do I bloody well prove I didn't poison the wine when 1,000 people saw me fill Joff's cup?
He did not sleep at all that night. Instead, he lay in the dark, staring up at the canopy and counting his ghosts. He saw Tysha smiling as she kissed him. Saw Sansa naked and shivering in fear. He saw Joffrey clawing his throat, the blood running down his neck as his face turned black. He saw Cersei's eyes, Bronn's wolfish smile, Shay's wicked grin. Even thought of Shay could not arouse him. He fondled himself, thinking that perhaps if he woke his cock and satisfied it, he might rest more easily afterward. But it was no good. And then it was dawn, and time for his trial to begin. It was not Sir Kevin who came for him that morning, but Sir Adam Marbrand, with 12 gold cloaks. Tyrion had broken his fast on boiled eggs, burned bacon, and fried bread, and dressed in his finest. "Sir Adam," he said, "I had thought my father might send the King's Guard to escort me to trial. I am still a member of the royal family, am I not?"
"You are, my lord, but I fear that most of the King's Guard stand witness against you. Lord Tywin felt it would not be proper for them to serve as your guards."
"Gods forbid we do anything improper. Please lead on."
He was to be tried in the throne room, where Joffrey had died. As Sir Adam marched him through the towering bronze doors and down the long carpet, he felt the eyes upon him. Hundreds had crowded in to see him judged. At least he hoped that was why they had come. "For all I know, they're all witnesses against me." He spied Queen Marjorie up in the gallery, pale and beautiful in her mourning.
"Twice wed, and twice widowed, and only 16.
Her mother stood tall to one side of her, her grandmother small on the other, with her ladies-in-waiting and her father's household knights packing the rest of the gallery. The dais stood beneath the empty iron throne, though all but one table had been removed. Behind it sat stout Lord Mace Tyrell, in a gold mantle over green, and slender Prince Oberyn Martell in flowing robes of striped orange, yellow, and scarlet. Lord Tywin Lannister sat between them. Perhaps